Hadi bakalım.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Human Reaction Podcast. We are doing the Home Alone edition. Everybody's out. Everyone's traveling the country except for me. So I thought I would do a little check-in from here at the house. You can see all my crap behind me. Good times. Excited to chat with you guys a little bit today about some politics that happened this week, developments on spending. Going to talk a little bit about the Mangione trial case and the Pentagon as related to the spending issue that I thought was an interesting development. So, but first, don't forget to like, subscribe, comment below. Those really boost the algorithm, means everything for the podcast. If you're on Spotify, please give us that five-star rank. We got a lot more Spotify subscribers than we do rankings in that system. So please go in there, give us that five-star. Really appreciate it. Or four-star, any less than three, I'm going to get a little skeptical. But please do. So, here I am at home. Let's get going into the House Christmas Omnibus. Before then, Discord. We got a Discord where we combine our YouTube and our Spotify and our RSS communities all in one place, get into some great discussions, and share some dank memes. So if you want to get on there, you could go to humanreactionpod.com where you can join our Discord. We also have some swag there you could check out, and you could become a paying member and jump into the skiff. This week, that's our members only exclusive product that we offer each week. I hope to be able to get to the skiff product this week. We'll see. It is kind of crazy with Christmas right now. But if not, we will double up and do a two skiff episode at a later date if we can. So first off, one of the great things of our Discord is the memes, and you got to check it out. So here is one of the meme of the show. We got House Speaker Johnson on top there saying, "It's okay, I'm in charge," with banged out Elon Musk below and, "Do you feel in charge?" And that directly relates to what happened early this week with the Christmas omnibus. So a little bit of background here. There's been a spending fight going on in Congress for some time, almost 2 years. Going back and forth since Republicans got a narrow majority in the 2022 election cycle in the House while Democrats maintained the Senate, the Republicans have been trying to leverage that narrow majority to try to get some kind of concessions out of the process on behalf of fiscal conservatism, trying to get some kind of fiscal restraint out of the administration. Now, has that been working? There have been marginal gains. But it hasn't been working to the degree that I think most of the people who have been operating on that have been desiring, right? So we got Speaker Mike Johnson out of that whole disagreement from his predecessor. And now Mike Johnson is in charge. He put forward H.R. 10445, which is a continuing resolution on Disaster Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act of 2025. The funding bill was supposed to run out today. This is the 20th. It'll run out, the funding of the government will run out midnight, and then we'll get a government shutdown, and which looks like might happen now, although I think we're going to see a lot of last-minute gamesmanship on these sorts of things. So the spending bill is totaling, that spending bill was totaling $110 billion. That's new spending on top of an automatic spending increase for the federal government to try to keep up with inflation. Obviously, we know that the deficit spending is one of the things that drives inflation, but that's what the bureaucrats got to try to get for themselves. So the baseline increase continues that. That's what a continuing resolution is, as opposed to appropriations and a regulatory budget process. And I have to mention this because I have to. It's just a thing I got to do. There is no avoiding it. I just want to remind everybody that we haven't had a regular budget process since before the creation of the iPad. Just think about that for a second. So with this continuing resolution process, we've seen as a continual degradation of that process where more and more things are being used in CRs and more things are being funded. New programs, new policies are being put into CRs, obviously violating the very concept of a continuing resolution, which is just to prevent a government shutdown so that you can have time to get into negotiation for actual appropriations. Since we implemented CRs, we haven't done that. It's just grown and grown and grown and really become the way that government does policy and does funding. So this one put forward by Speaker Johnson was going to fund the government till March of 2025, meaning that Trump would have a budget fight relatively early into his election, into him being president. Most of the new spending was in agriculture and in disaster relief. Some sketchy policy put in there as well, as in just to highlight, just to kind of give you a sense of just how bad the negotiations were here. Now, this was supposed to be a negotiation between the Senate leadership and the House leadership and the president. And what did the conservatives get out of it? It isn't really clear. It seems like to me they're really trying to own the disaster relief component of that. But it's strange because it's not like Democrats don't want disaster relief or disaster spending. Although a lot of these states that are at stake here, or the hurricane states, are more Republican states. It'd be surprising to me the degree to which they're holding that up, simply because Democrats typically like lots of FEMA spending. That said, possible. There's a lot of policy that's also going in, including, and I want to highlight two of these. One is a new global engagement center. Now, remember, that is from the censorship industrial complex. It's one of the things, one of the pillars of the censorship industrial complex are these global engagement centers, which exist to monitor online traffic to prevent security threats. So some of those originally being Al-Qaeda recruiting. Now it's spicy memes in the UK, or it could be today, you know, saying something wrong that the government doesn't like here in the United States that might get you deboosted in one of the back end list servers that we know that they have at Facebook and Google and these social media companies, unlike X. So Global Engagement Center was one of the things, a creation of a new one. The second was an NIH, it was National Institute of Health, Biolabs and Pandemic Response stuff. There's a lot in there for that. A lot of people cited that as one of the major reasons why they were very concerned about the bill, understandably, after 2020. And this is something that was definitely, provocative for them, because some of that definitely had language around it that looked like it could have something to do with what we saw with EcoHealth Alliance and the funding of research in viruses that might have created COVID-19 in the first place. That said, they don't know. It was a pretty vague and large statement, and it doesn't really matter that much now anyways. But it is important to remember what this means in terms of historical context, because this is a promise broken. Speaker Johnson earlier this year said no more omnibuses, no more minibuses, none of this stuff. We're done with that. This is a new era where we're going to fund government appropriately. And that was a broken promise. And then he came on, he defended the spending bill on his terms. And this is 1 week after the DOGE committee met in Congress, and where him and the Republicans were so pumped up about the engagement of a more proactive spending government efficiency regime. And then they put up this giant turd for everyone to do. And of course, Donald Trump came out against it. So we have Donald Trump here. Success in Washington. Speaker Mike Johnson and the House have come to a very good deal for the American people. The newly agreed American Relief Act of 2024 will keep the government open, fund our great farmers and others, and provide relief for those severely impacted by devastating hurricanes. A very important piece, vital to the American First agenda, was just out as well. The date of the very unsuccessful debt ceiling, unnecessary debt ceiling, will be pushed out 2 years to January of 2027. Now we can make America great again very quickly, which is what the people gave us a mandate to accomplish. All Republicans and even Democrats should do what's best for the country and vote yes for the bill tonight. So they killed the first bill and then brought in a new one that Donald Trump is very excited about. So what does that mean? What it means is normally the debt ceiling increases by a quantity amount. It usually says we're now setting the debt ceiling at 20 trillion, 25 trillion, stuff like that. And that, what that traditionally has meant is an opportunity for fiscal conservatives to get concessions out of the big spenders, moderate Republicans and Democrats. This is a different sort of debt ceiling that places it out to pretty much a blank check to not address the debt ceiling until 2027. This is a date rather than a number amount. And that is an interesting difference. Many people are calling this a blank check to the administration. There's a sense in which that's true in the fact that it isn't a quantitative amount which you would use to control debt. Instead, it is saying, of course, there's a regular appropriations process and stuff like that. But it does mean that they don't have to fight about the debt over that time. That takes a fight off Donald Trump. And obviously, it's better than a March debt fight, because he doesn't have to do it early in the administration, where he doesn't have all of his ducks in a row, perhaps. It's kind of shocking to see that that would be the case. Yet still, we're still sitting at a new budget proposal that funds the government much cleaner. And one of the things that we're citing, and it is a good thing, is there's less policy involved in this, far less pages involved in this. So less complexity added to the code, things like that. But what we're still looking at is overall just funding the government at the current rates with a slight increase. What it will do is add $5 trillion to the debt because it's not addressing any systemic funding problems. This is $30 billion to FEMA, less than what was in the earlier package. So if you take the earlier package as the baseline, this is less spending. It's less of a cut. But we're still sitting at a real problem with this, especially for me. It's the elimination of PAYGO. So PAYGO is a budgetary rule requiring that new legislation affected taxes or mandatory spending programs such as Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Think of those kind of big budget items. Does not increase the federal budget deficit. Under PAYGO, any increase in spending or decrease in revenues must be offset by corresponding cuts, spending cuts, or revenue increases elsewhere in the budget. Now, I know what you're saying. You're saying, David, but what about all the deficit spending that's been happening under PAYGO? Well, that's because Congress consistently offers waivers to PAYGO. It isn't a perfect solution. It hasn't worked to the degree that, of course, the fiscal conservatives wanted to do. But it's one of those things that, like, why is that missing out of here? Well, it's so that, you know, the Trump administration could, in theory, use the executive branch rulemaking authority to increase spending in these areas carte blanche, to the degree that that's enabled by code. There is a lot of flexibility in code for the executive to do that nowadays. That's a bad thing, something of powers that Congress wants to crawl back. So what we have here is now it's set up a conflict between Trump and the conservatives. And what we're really looking at here is a heck of a conflict. And I'll save the analysis for later, but it's one of those things that this is a strategy, right? A specific strategy to say we need a CR. We don't want to see a government. We don't want to see a government shutdown, which is costly for the momentum of the America First movement. That's Trump's case. If you read Truth Social, that makes sense. But when it went up for a vote yesterday, unfortunately, and this would be Thursday from the recording here, 38 Republicans voted against it. Chip Roy got up and gave a speech, I think, that articulates well what the fiscal conservatives of the House were most concerned about with this piece of legislation.
I was just texting with my son back home in Austin, who I haven't seen in quite a long time because I'm here trying to fight for him. When I got through cancer about 12 years ago, I made my promise to my kids that I would do everything I can to save this country. And what we're doing right now is to continue to double down on the things that are destroying the republic. We are going to increase the debt ceiling, not just $4 trillion, that's false. We have spent $4.7 trillion in additional debt in the last 19 months. We're gonna increase the debt by $5 trillion. That's what's gonna happen right here by Republicans, increasing the debt $5 trillion. And what are you doing in the same bill? $110 billion unpaid for, because you never have any ounce of self-respect to go out and campaign saying you're gonna balance the budget, and then you come in here and pass $110 billion unpaid for. On top of the $200 billion you did for WEP, you guys won't agree with that, but the fact of the matter is $330 billion, congratulations, you've added to the debt since you were given the majority again on November 5th. It's embarrassing. It's shameful. Yes, I think this bill is better than it was yesterday on certain respects, but to take this bill yesterday and congratulate yourself because it's shorter in pages but increases the debt by $5 trillion is asinine. And that's precisely what Republicans are doing. I am absolutely sickened by a party that campaigns on fiscal responsibility and has the temerity to go forward to the American people and say, you think this is fiscally responsible. It is absolutely ridiculous. It also turns off PAYGO. It turns off the $1.7 trillion in automatic cuts under PAYGO, because this side of the aisle is profoundly unserious about actually reducing deficits, just as my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are profoundly unserious about reducing deficits. The entire body has been racking up debt for my entire life. $36 trillion, $1 trillion of interest. We rack up $1 trillion every 100 days. Now, what are we going to do about it? We're going to run around and talk about cutting taxes, but not doing what's necessary to cut the spending along with the cut taxes. My other side of the aisle, my colleagues will say, oh no, we got to increase taxes, but we'll do anything to cut spending. And so here we sit in the same mess. And I got to be honest, I want to remind people, this is Article 1. I yield back.
Trump didn't like that at all. And not surprising, he went after Chip Roy on Truth Social, saying Chip Roy is just another ambitious guy with no talent. By the way, how's Bob Good doing? I hope some talented challengers are getting ready in the great state of Texas to go after Chip in the primary. He won't have a chance. And this is interesting, right? Because there's been a suspicious deficit of argumentation for this. Because, I mean, and that makes sense. Because the argumentation for this is shutdowns are really bad. We don't like them. And we need to do something about them. We need to keep them from happening because it's embarrassing to have the government shut down under your watch. Now, Donald Trump isn't president. The Democrats are president and control the Senate. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me at this current moment to really think about it in those terms. But the bully tactics are being applied to the right now. Right now. We have Mike Cernovich talking here, doing his thing. The real Chip Roy. He's a Liz Cheney defender, J6 truther who believed in every lie and wore a mask as he snotted into while crying. Wanted to ban Republicans from Congress for not sufficiently deferring to Joe Biden and supported the frame-up of Ken Paxton. Now, whether or not this is a good faith argument or not about Chip Roy isn't really material. It kind of follows the overall architecture. What we're seeing right now is threats to primaries and personal attacks for these Republicans that are doing this, saying you're bad on other stuff. Now, I get that. I get that people want to play an in-group, out-group game. But the problem with that is it just simply doesn't argue for your bill. It doesn't argue for why the Trump bill is better than a spending cut. If what we were going to find ourselves in was a situation where Democrats were going to vote against the bill, which they might have in the Trump situation, why not put in something that cuts rates? Why get rid of PAYGO? I mean, I could see the deficit, the debt ceiling thing. You're trying to say, hey, we're going to do this. We're going to cut a different direction, casting very clear vision of what you want to do as president that will cut the budget, which he has claimed to do in their election cycle. But now he's getting into governing. So how is he going to lead is then the question. And is he going to lead with conservatives at the front, the conservatives that want to cut the budget, that have been fighting for the last 2 years to do exactly that? Or is he going to lead by the way he did last time, in the last time he was president, where he spent like a drunken sailor? It's an interesting question. One that I think conservatives in the Congress are justifiably concerned about and trying to exert their just authority under Article 1 of the Constitution to try to place and keep constraints around. Especially for PAYGO. Remember, $1.7 trillion in savings over the long run because of PAYGO, because so many of these programs on the executive branch level are automatically increasing in spending. So if you're going to have that, and Trump's goal was to decrease spending, why would you get rid of PAYGO? Because it empowers you, Trump administration. It doesn't limit you in that sense. It only limits you in the sense that if you wanted to increase spending, so why are we doing this? Obviously, this is a thing that is a result of the omnibus system of large bills that are combined together to handle policy and spending and all these in a singular bill, usually negotiated by party elites well before anyone else can take a look at them. That was a big contention with the former bill by from Speaker Johnson. It's not as much as a contention this bill because it's shorter and it's more reasonable on many levels. Like Chip Roy says there, there's many benefits between these two bills. But he's saying that's a false dichotomy. And 38 other Republicans, all the best Republicans, to be clear, of the House, agree with that. All the ones that you like Thomas Massey, Matt Rosendale, Andy Ogles, all those guys all voted against it. The same guys who helped kill the other one. So what's going on here? Massey has a solution to this. And this is actually the constitutional solution in many senses, beyond if you're not going to get back to regulatory budget appropriations, is to CR by topic. So here's a tweet that he made soon after the failure of the bill, saying this isn't complicated. Separate the bills and vote on them individually. One vote on a clean CR, one vote on the debt limit, one vote on disaster relief, and one vote on farm bailouts. Radical, right? Individual bills for each issue. Now, that makes sense from the point of view of, you know, trying to get this across the line and from the point of view of what Trump really wants, which is a clean CR. So if you want a clean CR, do that. The trick is even then, I'm not sure all conservatives are going to get on board with that because it's simply not going all the way. But at least then you're putting the pressure on them, I think, in a more appropriate way than just threatening the primary to them. This is the best time possible to get spending reductions. Republicans just won overwhelmingly, right? They have a tremendous amount of cultural and political push right now. Additionally, that it's the longest you can be, literally the longest you can be from an election. So the election pressures are diminished. Nobody's worried about being primaried right now because it's a long way from the primaries. It's 2 whole years and then some. So people are really, I think, in a position where these kind of threats are not going to ring very thorough. I think it's a lot like the threats that were placed in 2020 during COVID when Thomas Massie stood up and made everybody else in Congress vote with an actual vote on the CARES Act or the CARES packages that were going out at the time in order to basically prop up governments and, you know, empower and fund the lockdowns. Lastly, we have here a report. It is reported today that congressional Republicans are considering the Massie perspective. So Benny Johnson reports breaking that House Republicans are reportedly exploring a plan to divide the spending bill into smaller parts for individual votes rather than passing it as a single package, according to Politico. So that's a good development. If that happens, man, the conservatives just won a big win. Individual votes are actually the constitutional way to do this, at least traditionally, before like the early 1900s, and before the 2000s, when we started combining everything into big omnibus bills and taking away the legislative process, taking away amendment processes, and empowers people to actually make floor amendments and things like that and actually debate things in Congress, believe it or not, and actually vote on actual legislation rather than giant bills that address 1,000 different things. So getting to the analysis part of this, I want to return to just the idea of a debt ceiling fight and what that means. So the typical way a debt ceiling fights is that Republicans, conservatives use them to get concessions on spending. Corporate media loses their minds and blames a government shutdown on Republicans if they fail to get it before going up. Now, it's this cat and mouse game. It's like, two cars running at each other, playing chicken, right? You're playing chicken with the other side, with the government shutdown being the other side, and Republicans swerve every time because the corporate media puts it on them. They're always the foil to the government shutdown because they're the stingy people who don't want to fund X important thing, maintaining the lawn on the White House, for example, or funding our parks. If you remember the government shutdown from the Trump administration, when that happened when he was president, what was cited was, well, all these parks are now, they're literally paying people. Get this, this is the scam. They literally pay a parks person to drive up to a park and close it down because the government's closed down. Think about that. So this sort of like gamesmanship that happens around this is the biggest threat. The biggest threat to a government shutdown is not so much the government shutting down. Everyone knows that the government pretty much funds itself regardless. It has lots of money in many senses. There's lots of backups to a lot of these things. It puts a crunch on budgets in the short run. They usually make up for that for outlays for critical resources and critical things that are needed. And, you know, the question at this point is we just did this election where conservatives made the case that we have a new media environment now. X, Doge, these new kinds of structures in the cathedral of our society itself have changed the game and how these sorts of things will be interpreted, could be interpreted. They were during the election cycle. It's why Trump won so overwhelmingly beyond the normal, the other, you know, kind of more political explanations for what's happening. So if you explain the election by a new media environment, and then as soon as you start to govern, you have governing processes happening, and you abandon that, say, oh, the corporate media is going to say bad things about us. Did you really believe that in the first place? The question is, like, is the overwhelming like power of the new social media environment granted X and the podcasting environment, stuff like that, will that back a government shutdown on principled matters of reducing spending or not? As long as we have a dialogue that says more spending on disaster relief equals good, even though the FEMA is already funded to hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, even though there was already a package just recently, only a couple months ago, for another $100 billion specifically for hurricane relief, we have to do it again, just in case, right? And that's that thing that, like, it wasn't enough last time. Maybe there's an argument there. We could have that argument, but we're not. And that's why one of the reasons why individual packages would be better, much like the appointment process that Trump has gone through. Social media can handle all these tiny issues happening one right sequentially right after the other. And you can fund the government, and then you can have an actual social debate about these things. And then additionally, that the election time frame, this time frame is unique in that Republicans have this tremendous momentum, just won the White House, to have their agenda being confirmed by the American public to such a degree that you can have this debt ceiling fight with less electoral pressure than you normally would. This is also dividing between populist and principled. So the populist factions of the Republicans, they trust Trump to operate with a high debt ceiling, or operate with this debt ceiling for this time frame, to cut programs in theory, right? And spending as an executive. So he's gonna reform programs and cut spending as an executive and then create savings then, as opposed to, you know, and they trust him to do that. While the more principled people are saying, yeah, we want to trust you. We like you better than Biden. But my brother, the 4 years you were president last time didn't really go that way. I know it's a promise that you said that you made mistakes on or are going to change now. But if you look at how he has explained his spending habits last time around, he really blames them on COVID-19. He's not mentioned the other 3 years in which he ran a budget deficit. So the actual budget process he could have went through in 2016 and 2017, when he had a Republican House and Senate, a better majority in the Senate then than he does now, well, how did he behave? So they're looking to that and they're saying, wait a minute, pump the brakes here. We need, if we're going to go that direction, we need to get wins now, not go back and say, well, we really tried again, because it is getting to a breaking point in a lot of ways. And additionally, that Elon Musk himself has made this case repeatedly, saying, you know, that the government itself is the origin of inflation. It's not simply greedy businessmen who are out there raising prices. The total quantity of money is increasing, and that is what's driving prices. So when you're this far from election with a mandate from the public, do you prioritize spending or not? Now, spending is more difficult to argue to the public in many ways. A lot of people have a hard time keeping budgets in their mind, keeping kind of that calculus going or understanding what's really happening with that. But the public needs to be made the case for why spending is the origin of tyranny. It is what actually creates the policies, not the policies themselves. It is the spending on the policies in as much as anything else. So if you reform the policies, but you keep the spending high, you maintain the problem, the fundamental problem of big government and the ultimate form of taxation. One of the things that Trump ran on this year this year, 2024, was continuing the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Now, the great error of that was to do that without spending cuts. So if he's planning on doing that again, that's going to drive up the deficit more, which is already almost $1 trillion. It already is the fastest growing budget item is our deficit. So we have to do something about that, according to the principal people. So what is the Trump strategy here? Which is an interesting dialogue, and I really got to give credit to Adam because he really helped tease these questions out this morning on our Discord. So join. I suspect it was to put up a moderate bill. You know, allow that process to happen, kill it, and put up a marginally better policy that would have eliminated some spending and the debt fights for as much of his term as possible to get that done out of the way, so it doesn't have to be addressed. The problem there, and then in theory go through the constitutionally mandated, the normal budget process of 12 bills, each coming from a committee governing that direction for the government, where the congressional purse strings power actually means something, where they can say, I'm going to fund this program, not this program, or I'm going to cut this program by that much. That's in theory how you actually lock the next administration into what you're doing if you lose the presidency but maintain the Congress. And then you actually have a bludgeon to say, hey, you are not doing your congressional duty to submit a budget, president, so we're going to submit a budget, and you get back to that same place we were at in the early 2000s, which was itself insane in some levels, but better than it was now. In fact, we ran a budget surplus in the late 1990s simply with that method of having an actual budgetary process and a split government between a House and a Democrat. It could have been, the Trump strategy could have been to make Democrats the ones who voted for a shutdown by engaging, enraging them for killing their policies in the first bill and then it dies in the Senate. Chuck Schumer takes the blame for the shutdown. Now, that's kind of the X policy, like we're the media now policy. That's kind of putting faith into the new media structure. And, you know, if it loses in the Senate, then you can pin it on Senate Democrats for the shutdown. But right now, I wouldn't suggest that that's actually where we're at least when it comes to the culture of D.C. Now, the larger American public, I think, is more, you know, as proven by, at least demonstrated, maybe an anecdotal, singular data point. But with the rise of podcasting and social media, something that appeals to the larger base of Americans, but doesn't matter as much in the culture of D.C. when it comes to these questions of this outside pressure. The corporate media still has a lot of power in the Beltway. So if that was the strategy, it's congruent on testing that we are the media now part. And it says, you know, you ask your question, okay, so why that plan? Why eliminate pay-go? Well, if you're going to put off the debt ceiling, why not do a budget cut in this? Say this CR is only going to increase by less than, rather than the regular amount, half that amount or a third that amount or even three quarters of the amount. Just saying we got something for these people who have been fighting for a budget sanity for the last 2 years, doing anything they can to try to get some actual concessions. Because remember, the origin of our tyranny is spending and as much as it is policies. And lastly, I have to ask if the Trump team simply miscalculated, if they just didn't understand the dynamics of Congress in this condition. That's hard to imagine in many senses, but you know, it could be that whole sense of we have the mandate. These Republicans will go along with it because we're the ones with the mandate. They're not the ones who won every district in America, except for like one. They're the ones who captured Congress and got the hold of the Senate. But they're not the ones that have the same amount of cultural backing that Trump does. And additionally, that they have only 2 years between elections. So maybe we can primary the bad ones and we could use that as a threat. We could bully them into position. Now, the problem with that is that now that Trump is on the same side as the Democrats on this issue, which isn't a good look. And if for those who are more interested in what are we actually going to do here tangibly to make a difference. So and then last, what it could have been is pressure on the Democrats to not shut down the government. What it became, however, I theorize, is a pressure on conservative Republicans to be primaried by Trump loyalists, which you have to ask yourself, is that a good thing? Now, I understand with people are saying we have to act as a group. We have to coalesce. We have to coordinate and collaborate and work together. But the question that always remains is, to what end are you doing that? Power itself is a very dangerous thing. The exercise of power is something you have to constrain. It's the One Ring, man. You got to find systems to try to constrain the One Ring. That's what the founders did. That's what the best people do. You have to make compromise along the way. I don't think congressional Republicans in this case are saying there is no compromise they're willing to make. I think what they're saying is, we want something out of this process. You're supposed to be on our side, remember? So, and part of that, and I think was relevant, is what happened with the Pentagon reporting about Syria this week. And if you're saying, well, we can't do a CR that just cuts everything, that would mean cutting defense, which is the typical line that moderate Republicans use to bludgeon the heads with the conservatives.
As you know, we have been briefing you regularly that there are approximately 900 U.S. troops deployed to Syria. In light of the situation in Syria and the significant interest, we recently learned that those numbers were higher. And so asked to look into it, I learned today that, in fact, there are approximately 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria. As I understand it, as it was explained to me, these additional forces are considered temporary rotational forces that deploy to meet shifting mission requirements, whereas the core 900 deployers are on longer-term deployments. And as you know, for many of our deployments, numbers will fluctuate from time to time. But given that this number is significantly higher than what we've been briefing, I wanted to let you know as soon as I found out this information.
So we can't possibly cut by more. After all, we're not even really sure where our troops are at. And this has to come on top of a Pentagon budget failure. They failed their seventh audit in a row. This is reported on by The Hill. And the implications of that is simply that, man, if we can't cut there, can we cut anywhere? And this is really the question of that discretionary, non-discretionary spending. We have a lot of things that are automatically increased with Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, all that kind of stuff. They need systemic policy reforms there. Even as you're looking at the question of how to spend less, you have to do something that restrains those programs and how they apply or what they work, because we have a booming population of retirees who are demanding Social Security and healthcare benefits from those programs. And then we have, you know, an increasing population that are falling into the line of the poverty programs that are also a problem. Of course, you do need to solve that by growing out of it. You do need to solve that by regulatory reform. In a lot of ways, that's true. But in the meantime, you have to bend that cost curve, or otherwise you run into the debt trap of $1 trillion, sorry, of deficit spending becoming the largest budget item. So all my cases here, and I'm not even sure that I'm saying that I'm on one side of the principle versus populist. All I'm saying is that there is a game being played. And in the rules of that game, you have to watch out for how you're interpreting and where you're aiming towards. And if Republicans or the Trump-aligned Republicans got over their skis on those sorts of things, there's still time. You could still do additional CRs. A short government shutdown is not a big deal. I've been there. I've lived through them. I know exactly what they're like. They don't work the way the media portrays them, where they are like everyone just kind of falls over dead. Most people work from home already. If you turn off the lights of all those buildings and reduce, I don't know, staple budgets and paper budgets and stuff like that, I don't think that means the government's going to collapse and we're going to fall into tyranny or anarchy immediately. Okay, so last topic, I just want to dive into Luigi Mignone charges with terrorism. So he was originally charged with murder. They brought in terrorist charges. And I think this is a very interesting development, specifically because the way the left has reacted to this. And I had some reaction material, but I want to shorten it up a little bit here for you guys. So the left is kind of like outraged by the terrorism charge. They're kind of surprised by it, even as the left is celebrating the use of this murder in order to intimidate people they don't like. And this digs into something that we got. We had a commenter on the last YouTube that had a lot of great points, asking, what do we mean by the CEO killing being symbolic? And what I meant by it is that there's a certain group of people who see the world, and this is definitely people of the left, but it has a upper class, lower class divide. Another question that we got and discussion we got into, which is that there is bad people who are in charge. And one of the bad people that are in charge are CEOs because of the position they're at as CEOs. And this goes along with a lot of cultural norms that we have inherited from the progressive era that say, if you're on that hierarchy, if you're at the top of a hierarchy, you must have done something bad to get there. Necessarily, you have abused your employees. It's kind of the Marxist theory, labor of value kind of going on in there, kind of like embedded in that premise. There's also a kind of theory of, well, there's no real way to grow in the economy other than by fraud, by defrauding people. And obviously a lot of people are looking to health insurance companies in cases of where they say they have defrauded their customers. Okay, possibly. But the problem here, and this is the point I was trying to make, is that there is an idea of justice that is embedded within that. There is a group and collective guilt for all people who are high on the hierarchy that is often informed by a psychological desire and underlying anxiety and need for a sense of justice that is, I think, rooted in resentment. Rooted in the resentment for all the things that are wrong with the world. You blame the people who are at the top, specifically because the people at the top must be responsible for the world that you inherited, that which was full of suffering and bad things. And we've seen this in the reaction to the killing. People will get onto TikTok and they'll say, well, my dad died from a hospital procedure that wasn't covered. Therefore, the insurance company is bad, right? Or something like that, without really citing how that related, right? And that doesn't mean that's not a tragedy. And I sympathize with that tragedy. I know exactly what that person's going through. In many ways, not in their circumstance, but in circumstances that have been similar in my life. But there isn't the particularized suspicion is the reason why we do justice the way we do, for good reasons. We want to hold individuals accountable for what they do, not groups of people accountable for the suffering of the world that is normal and part of living in a world of scarcity. So my overall point of being, we don't want to pretend that if we just regulate that insurance enough, that'll get rid of scarcity. And the symbolism there of the hierarchy being corrupt, that the people at the top are all the same, that you can treat somebody who is dropping bombs inside Russia as a policy and advocating for that is the same as the person who inherited a healthcare large insurance company and ran it according to the rules of the game that they were given to by the government as the same sort of corruption. It is not the same as just saying Hunter Biden was appointed or was pardoned by his dad while appearing to be very guilty of some very serious crimes of influence peddling as a person related to the president without registering under that act. Important people for the Democrat process know, right? Like this is a real threat to the democracy, if you will, to not know that the president's son is a foreign influence agent. To treat that person or that scenario of particularized examples of guiltiness to all CEOs are guilty because of complaints that I have about the overall structure of our world that I wish would just go away. And of course, that point is not made better or improved in any real substantial degree by simply collectivizing it, because that's what we've already been doing. We've been collectivizing healthcare for 100 years, and it's actually made things worse in many ways. So what part of that is the left-right analysis? The reason why I tend to point to the left on this is because in general, it is the left ideas, the progressive influence of leftist ideas on our culture that has said someone is necessarily guilty of being suspicious or, I don't know, they might have been bad. He might have deserved it. That itself is a heck of a suspicious starting premise to the argument for justifying a murder of a particular individual for the group collective that of guilt that he belongs to for belonging to the wrong group. Last part of that, and I think this is a particularly interesting one because I think it relates to lots of other things in our society, which is corporate lobbying exists. Do we blame United Healthcare for their cartel status, or do we blame the politicians, or do we blame both? And I think obviously there's a sense in which it's both, right? United Healthcare has the position it does to deny claims in the marketplace and have such enormous impact, in part because they've seen a cartelization of the healthcare insurance industry as we've regulated it more and more and more and subsidized it more and more and more. Over that time, United Healthcare plays a role in that. The question is once again, you don't want to be too lazy about your accusations, right? If they are particularly examples, to what degree is this guy responsible for that? You got to make the case. And the second to that, to what point is it, you know, this is a cartel because they have fought to make it a cartel? Well, that's an interesting question. So let's look at one example of that. This isn't the whole case, but this is an example. In 2009, United Healthcare spent about $5 million on lobbying. As a larger insurance company, that's not that much, especially, but it's still about a bit of money. When you compare it to the overall health insurance industry and their lobbying in 2009, which was $270 million, I don't know how much you can lay all of Obamacare at their feet, especially given the fact that the existing information that we have about that mostly places them in a, we want to make sure Medicaid Advantage is sufficiently funded because that's one of our products. If you're offering Medicaid Advantage and the Affordable Care Act is saying, we're going to reduce payments for Medicaid Advantage so that you have to carry more burden, healthcare industry, that means that they have to deny more claims. So in this case, even that in that case doesn't really match for that. It actually is them fighting for sufficient government spending for the things that they have to do according to the rules in order to make sure it's sufficiently funded so that they can actually run a model that has profit in it. You can't run a model that doesn't have profit in it because that means you go bankrupt. And that means people's capital that they've invested into the insurance company, be it through the stock market or through existing premiums, themselves have to be accounted for. There's a balance sheet there that has to zero out. You can't just pretend like that scarcity doesn't exist. So if you try to transfer that, you try to pillage that by a rule, that could result in terrible things happening, such as more denials of claims because you have scarcity to contend with. If you just ignore scarcity and just pretend that you know the numbers enough to be able to say, oh, from the outside, I can just judge that carte blanche without any case being made, without any systematic look at the books, I'm not exactly sure that you have a case that at least I'm willing to buy onto. And I don't know if people should, because I think it's a minimum a weak case, if not one that's driven less so by the facts on the ground of what's actually happening and more so on the, I don't like this person because he represents dad, because he represents the hierarchy, the patriarchy, the thing that itself I contend with that I don't like in how our social order works. additionally, that there is an underlying resentment that goes with that, that is more, I think, informing of where people are reacting to this than anything else. Anyways, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the Home Alone special with me alone. I'm going to try editing this. We'll see how it goes. So don't forget, like, follow, subscribe. Check us out on TikTok and X. TikTok before it gets canceled? That's a good question. I might cover that next week because it's going to be like the last week TikTok exists. We'll see you more next time.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.